Welcome to Hub History, the show that brings you fascinating stories from Boston's history. This is episode 2, How Cotton Mather Saved Boston. Hi, I'm Jake.
And I'm Nikki. And this week, we're going to be looking at the Puritan minister Cotton Mather and how he became a most unlikely champion of a scientific response to disease.
Cotton Mather was both the son and grandson of Puritan ministers, and he was a deeply influential figure in colonial Boston as both a minister and a writer. Most people probably know him best from his role in the Salem witch trials.
I've read that he had a very unique method of detecting witchcraft and curing women of witchcraft that basically involved having the young ladies disrobe and then he would rub the spirits out of them. But we're going to see how this witch trial judge could take a very scientific approach to medicine. But first, it's time to take a look at what's coming up this week in Boston history.
Monday's November 7th, and that marks the anniversary of James Michael Curley's election to a fourth term as Boston mayor in 1945, setting a record that only Tom Menino has broken. All told, Curley spent 4 terms as mayor, 2 terms as a congressman, 1 term as governor, and 2 terms in jail.
And speaking of election anniversaries, November 8th was the date of JFK's election to the presidency in 1960. And then Wednesday is the 9th, and on November 9th, 1872, a fire started that burned all of what we consider the financial district today and became known as Boston's Great Fire. And so we'll have a map of the burned district on the show notes for today's episode.
Friday is Veterans Day, and it's also Abigail Smith Adams' birthday. Our first Second Lady and second First Lady was born on November 11th, 1744.
Speaking of Abigail Adams, there's a great quote in a letter from her to John on November 12th, 1775. She'd been to church, and the minister had said a prayer that was pretty standard for the early revolution, hoping for a peaceful reconciliation with Britain. And here's what Abigail had to say about that. "I could not join in today in the petitions of our worthy parson for a reconciliation between our no longer parent state, but tyrant state, and these colonies. Let us separate. They are unworthy to be our brethren. Let us renounce them, and instead of supplications as formerly for their prosperity and happiness, let us beseech the Almighty to blast their counsels and bring to naught all their devices."
Fiery lady.
Hear, hear.
Our story today is going to start in 1721, on a cold November morning in Boston, when somebody throws a homemade grenade through Cotton Mather's window. Luckily, it didn't go off, so he could see the attached message. "Cotton Mather, you dog! Damn you! I'll inoculate you with this! A pox to you!"
Oh, that's very Shakespearean.
Yeah, you can imagine Mercutio saying that. So Cotton Mather, like we said, is this very influential Puritan minister, probably one of the most respected clergy in New England at that time. He's the son of Increase Mather, and he's the grandson of both John Cotton and Richard Mather, all of whom were giants in the Puritan church.
So Cotton Mather is such an influential figure in Boston history, and someone who's going to be featured in many upcoming podcast episodes. So how does he end up with somebody trying to blow up his house?
Well, to put it in modern terms, he got on the wrong side of the anti-vaxxers. There was a big smallpox outbreak in Boston in 1721, and Mather was pushing hard for a new way to fight the disease.
As 21st century Americans, I think it's really hard for us to imagine how terrifying smallpox was for people around the world, really throughout most of human history.
Yeah, it's hard for me to imagine anything scarier than going a whole day without 4G on my phone.
That is scary for you. Now, there are estimates that the disease was killing up to 20% of the population in Europe throughout the mid-1700s. And then, of course, once Europeans come to the Americas, smallpox just wipes out the Native American population.
Sometimes deliberately, of course.
Yes. And here in Boston, we are no strangers to the fear of smallpox. There have been a whole series of smallpox epidemics before this point, killing lots of Bostonians at a time when the population was quite small.
There's a 1723 map of Boston by John Bonner, which we'll use as a source in future episodes as well. In the bottom left corner, where the key is that shows points of interest in the city, there's a list of great fires. And then right next to that, there's also a list of smallpox outbreaks. It lists epidemics in 1649, 1666, 77, 89, 1702, and finally 1721, killing thousands.
And in April of 1721, a ship arrives in Boston Harbor from Britain, and one of the sailors is sick. So they quarantine him to try to prevent the disease from spreading, but some of the other crew are already infected, and as they move through the city, smallpox begins to spread rapidly through the population.
And just as an aside, that's almost exactly how the deadly 1918 Spanish flu epidemic got its start in Boston. First one sailor, then the rest of the crew, they're moving through the city, and pretty soon it's a global pandemic. But more on that in a future episode.
Luckily, Cotton Mather has an experimental treatment he wants to use to try to save Boston from smallpox.
Now, the first recorded use of inoculation against smallpox is in China. And depending on which source I believe, it's probably in the 1400s, but maybe as long ago as the 1000 BC.
That's a pretty big spread for sources, though.
Yeah, some seem more reliable than others. One thing they agree on, though, is what the practice of inoculation was like in China. And I'm just going to read a brief quote. In China, the practice was to blow dried and ground variola scabs into the nostrils of the patient.
That is grosser than goose poop.
Oh, we're only getting started. Now, if we take that 1400s date, by that time, China's already trading with the Middle East along the Silk Road, and the Middle East has strong religious and cultural ties with North Africa. And the practice of inoculation spreads through these trading ties from China to the Middle East to Africa to Boston.
That's quite a chain.
It really is. Cotton Mather first heard about the concept of inoculation in 1706 from an enslaved African who was family-owned and called Onesimus. Onesimus had been inoculated as a child in Africa, and he described the process to Cotton Mather, where some pus from an infected person's pox was introduced into a cut on the patient. Now, shortly after that time, a British noblewoman and a British doctor who were traveling separately through Turkey observed the use of inoculation there, and they brought accounts back to England. So by the time 1721 rolls around, Cotton Mather has both a first-hand account of inoculation in Africa from his slave Onesimus, and then he's also read scientific accounts from Britain of inoculation in Turkey.
You know, I always picture early Boston as this tiny colonial outpost on the absolute outer fringes of the British Empire. But this story really paints a much more global picture of, you know, what the world was like and what Boston's place was in it at that time.
So when people start dying of smallpox in Boston in 1721, Cotton Mather's pretty sure he knows the best way to save them.
But the problem is that all of Boston's doctors at that time thought that inoculation was a terrible idea. Why would you deliberately expose someone to one of the most deadly diseases in history? And Mather eventually wins over a physician named Zabediel Boylston, which, yes, Boylston Street is named after Zabediel Boylston. Now, Boylston and Mather end up testing out inoculation on their own families, on their children, and on enslaved Africans in their households.
Which, I'll just point out, would be considered completely unethical in modern medicine.
After they very publicly inoculate their families, and their families survive, they start to get patients. And with the patients, then comes the controversy.
So there's a lot of resistance to inoculation at first, and that resistance falls into three categories. Medical, religious, and racist. This is all very well preserved because all the parties involved were writing open letters to each other in the local newspapers. The medical argument's pretty much what you already laid out. As far as the medical community was concerned, inoculation was completely untested, it was based on what they considered primitive folklore, and it was dangerous to expose patients to a deadly disease on purpose.
Not surprising that the doctors were skeptical.
No, not at all. And it didn't help that the only university-educated physician in town was also the loudest voice against inoculation. Dr. William Douglas had a medical degree from Edinburgh, and he didn't think this was consistent with his training.
Which it wasn't.
Douglas, though, he's also a very vocal racist critic of inoculation. A lot of his letters in the Boston Courant argue that relying on the accounts of enslaved Africans was untrustworthy because African people just didn't have the capacity to think rationally.
And just as a reminder here, African people at this time have the longest experience with the concept of inoculation of any of the parties involved, and they're still alive, which somewhat proves that it's working.
I know, it's infuriating to read these accounts today. But of all the arguments against inoculation, religious resistance was probably the easiest thing for Cotton Mather to overcome. Many religious people believed that epidemics were a punishment sent by God to punish a society for their wicked behavior.
Which, this is an argument that we have all heard before.
Yeah, from Hurricane Katrina to the AIDS epidemic, whenever there's a disaster in our society, some version of this argument always comes up. But Cotton Mather became convinced that inoculation was actually a gift from God sent to deliver mankind from unnecessary suffering. So he asked, quote, "Whether a Christian may not employ this medicine and humbly give thanks to God's good providence in discovering it to a miserable world."
So it sounds like he wins over the religious opposition.
Yeah, he just has enough stature in the Puritan church to batter his way through any of the religious arguments. And then eventually the numbers prove him right from a medical perspective as well. Nikki, can you describe what this controversial practice is actually like?
I thought you would never ask. Now, I don't know about you, but when I think about smallpox inoculation, I picture a visit to my doctor's office.
Yeah, I go every year for my flu vaccine. I have to get it for work. I just got it a few days ago. And there's a spotless exam room. The nurse walks in with a tiny little needle and says, oh, this might pinch a little bit. And before you know it, I'm back out the door.
So inoculation and vaccination are not the same thing. So I'm just going to put that out on the table first. And inoculation back then is both grosser and bloodier than what we experience today as vaccination.
Oh boy.
So keep in mind what we're trying to do. Since acquiring smallpox through the blood is less severe than if you're getting it through your mucous membranes, we're trying to get the pus from another person's smallpox blister, or maybe their powdered scabs, into your bloodstream.
All right, that's already pretty gross.
And I'm just getting warmed up here. Now, physicians had some pretty elaborate preparations for inoculation that could involve fasting, special diets, refraining from exercise, bloodletting, laxatives, enemas, all of these rituals that we know weaken the body before you were going to put the body under attack.
But that just tells us that medicine was crazy back then. How did inoculation itself work?
So I'm going to use future President John Adams as an example here.
My favorite president.
So he goes in for inoculation in 1764 under the supervision of future Patriot leader Dr. Joseph Warren.
Your favorite patriot.
Absolutely. Now, he describes the process in a letter to his fiancée, Abigail, on April 13th, 1764. And John says, "They took their lancets and with their points divided the skin for about a quarter of an inch, and just suffering the blood to appear, buried a thread about a quarter of an inch long in the channel. A little lint was then laid over the scratch, a piece of rag pressed on, and then a bandage bound all over."
So let me just get this straight. They're cutting a gash in your arm, they're smearing in a thread that's been soaked in somebody else's pus, and then they're bandaging you up? That's not quite so quick and painless as my flu shot.
Yes, but did it work as well?
Well, I'm looking at a graph of death rates from smallpox in Boston, 1702 to 1900. And you see this very clear drop from 1721 to 1730 as inoculation is introduced. Dr. Boylston claims that 2% of his patients died during the 1721 smallpox outbreak, compared to about 14% of the total population. About 800 people died in all, out of a population of about 11,000 at that time. So if inoculation reduces the risk that much, you can see why it became so popular. However, it's not without controversy. In 1776, during the Revolution, the governor of Connecticut writes to Massachusetts authorities to complain about smallpox inoculation, saying, quote, "The practice of inoculating for the smallpox, which has been fallen into by the troops from your state, every way hurts the public service and exposes the other troops anew to that infection."
So this is 55 years after inoculation is introduced, and if inoculation is known to be saving lives by this point, why is it still so controversial?
Well, it was saving lives, but it was still risky business. Keep in mind that you're still deliberately infecting people with smallpox, you're just doing your best to make sure it's a mild case.
So people can still get sick.
Oh yeah, you could still die from an inoculated case of smallpox, and even if you didn't die, you could get very, very sick. When Abigail Adams takes John Quincy and the rest of the Adams children in to get inoculated in the summer of 1776, the family remains sick for well over a month. Some of them have to be re-inoculated to ensure they get enough antibodies, and Charles, the fourth child, almost died.
So if people are getting sick for a month or more, then you can see why the military wasn't so keen on inoculating the troops.
And why scientists were looking for a better way.
By the end of the 18th century, an Englishman named Edward Jenner develops the modern idea of vaccination that we're familiar with today. And instead of using a smallpox virus to fight smallpox, he uses a mild disease called cowpox that still builds an immunity to the smallpox.
Yeah, and if you go back to that graph I referenced of the deaths from smallpox, the numbers just fall off a cliff after vaccination comes to Boston in 1800.
So here's just a really fascinating tidbit, I think, here. So the first person who was vaccinated for smallpox got the vaccine from Edward Jenner himself. Now, Jenner had developed the vaccine from cowpox blisters on a milkmaid's hands, and the milkmaid got cowpox from a cow named Blossom. And Blossom's hide is now mounted on the wall of the library of St. George's Medical School in England.
So she's famous forever.
Yes.
Okay, where can people find out more about Cotton Mather and smallpox?
We'll post the Bonner map of Boston showing the list of smallpox epidemics, the graph of smallpox mortality in Boston, and a link to John Adams' description of getting inoculated in the show notes for this week's episode at hubhistory.com/002.
If you want to get in touch with us, you can go to hubhistory.com and click on the Contact Us link, or email us at podcast@hubhistory.com. We'd love to read your comments on the show.
We're on Facebook at facebook.com/hubhistory, and our Twitter handle is @hubhistory. And that's all for now. We'll see you next week.